Hey, it's Dave from System Hub here, and we've got another great interview for you with Kerry Bolton. Now, we've found quite recently that we're moving in some similar circles and have done for a long time, but we never really connected until we ended up getting a shared mutual client. Now, Kerry runs a group called the Exit Strategy Group, and basically, in short, she helps businesses get top dollar when it comes to selling their business, and she's worked with some huge names over the past few decades, everything from your Domino's to Telstra to Toyota's to even down to small mum and pop companies looking at, you know, what do they do when they're kind of ready for retirement and what are they going to do with their business. She's been featured in numerous different publications. She's an author, a speaker, and very much still a hands-on consultant, which I love because then you have like a real deep knowledge of the subject matter. So definitely with great pleasure I get to interview her today. So first of all, Kerry, welcome and thanks for making the time.
Oh, thank you very much, Dave. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh, good. Now, being a little bit of a systems guy, what I'm super keen to do is work through your system for the way that you groom businesses for sale. Because I think the vast majority of them, businesses, they don't think about selling, particularly right up front when they're setting things up. And oftentimes they just close the door when they're ready for retirement. So I think it's more the exception rather than the rule for companies that sell. And I know you've got a four-step process that you like to take your clients through, and that's really what I'm keen to uncover. So maybe my first question, and then that'll kind of kick into things, is what makes a business saleable, and when should you really start thinking about getting your business ready for sale?
Dave, I think the most, probably the crucial part of all of that is that the best time to start thinking about it is when you've actually when you're actually starting your business, let alone when you are down the track and you suddenly think, oh, I've had enough and I want to get out. But given that most people do not do that, the best time to start thinking about it is now, regardless. Even if your business is a really good, strong, viable business, it's not always saleable. And one of the reasons for that is that so much of what happens in a business often resides in somebody's head or in some key people's heads. And very little of it is really set down and systemized, which dovetails beautifully, of course, into what you do. So having had the great fortune, really, to be able to have my own businesses and to be able to have built those and sold them, not often do you get that opportunity to do it more than once, but at least I've had it personally. And so I have firsthand deep experience of what it's really like. And so knowing that there's such a big wave coming with baby boomers, I thought, you know, there's not a lot of information out there about how to prepare your business like that and yourself particularly as well for exit. And so I created a four-step process, as you said, which is around the acronym of EXIT, and that is to evaluate. Number one, that's a step number one, is to evaluate. Number two is to explore. Number three is then to innovate. And number four, of course, is to transition. And the time frame around that, of course, just will vary depending on the individual and the businesses involved.
Yeah, perfect. So let's dive into step number one, which is to evaluate. What's involved there?
Yeah. So first and foremost, it's about take the temperature of where you're at now with your business and with yourself. So most people have little idea of what they think of what their business is worth, and often it's an inflated idea, even if they do actually have some sort of notion, or the notion of the value of the business is around what they need, you know, for the future, when in fact that may not necessarily relate to the business directly. So the first thing we do is run through a couple of benchmarking tools to get an idea of where the business actually sits against best practice in their particular industries. And they're not difficult tools to run through. They're quite easy, and they're very they're very descriptive, you know, that really looks at the key drivers in the business and gives you some feedback on where you sit, where the gaps are mainly, and at the same time gives you a number, which would be a type of a financial valuation, not a formal valuation, it's just an estimate so that you can test the water around what you think your business is worth and what the world at large is saying this business is worth.
So with that, so are we talking, obviously, profit is going to be part of it. I'm imagining if we're talking about valuing a business here, we'd be talking about what are the assets the business has. What are some of the other things that someone might consider when calculating the value?
Sure. Really, it's about looking at the key underlying drivers that are in a business that are somebody who is potentially looking at the business might look for. And if any of these are out of whack, this is when you're when this is what devalues a business. So and the whole thing of a business really is about its transferability, which of course dovetails beautifully into what your underlying business is around and what that creating systems is all about. Basically, we're looking at, first of all, financial performance. Naturally, you're going to have a good track record in terms of your financial performance for at least the last 3 years, and let's have a look and see where that's heading. That's not only your profit and loss account, but also your balance sheet. So that's where your assets come into play. Second thing we'd be looking at would be growth potential. Is there room in the business to grow? So a lot of business owners, run the business over the top. They don't actually think about, they think more about the short-term gains rather than the potential long-term gain, when in fact selling your business could be the biggest payday that you'll ever have in your life. So so growth potential, what's out there in terms of the market? Next one would be about looking at how reliant is the business on any one key customer? Is there, a customer concentration? Is there a supplier concentration? Are you a distributor for a major technology, for instance, or some products that that represent, more than 50% of your business? Then, that's an issue that has to be addressed. And maybe there's some staff, some key people in your business. So let's have a look and see how reliant are you on those and what we can do to minimise the risks associated with that. Another key driver, of course, is cash flow. Does your business generate cash or does it use cash? So no matter what happens in the future, there's always two numbers. One's obviously the number, the value that they're going to sell, that the buyer is going to pay for the business. And the second one is working capital. So there's always two numbers. And the more cash that a buyer might have to put in, then obviously the less they're going to pay you for the business, because there's more than one number. So do you generate cash or do you use cash? Okay. And one of the other main key drivers is business differentiation. So value proposition. Have you got a moat around your business? Are you positioning yourself so that you've got something that's really different, that's unique, that sets you apart from your competitors? That's the famous one that Warren Buffett often talks about, that he really only ever looks at businesses that have that differentiation, where they stand out in the crowd and they're not subjected to constant competition. So that's really, really important. Another key driver, of course, as well is revenue, recurring revenue. Do you have a business that generates ongoing billing? Or do you have to go out and crack a sale every single time? And I'll use as an example that people will no doubt understand fairly readily, and that is in real estate. And when you've got a real estate sales business, you've got your people having to go out there and get their listings, and they're going to have to sell those properties. So that's ongoing. But at the same time, value lies in the property management side of the business. So where they're managing rentals, and there's a constant income that's coming from rental, that's coming through the system, and the rental commissions that the agents are earning to manage the properties. So that recurring revenue creates enormous value in a business if somehow you have that, where the client is where you're not having to generate a sale every single time. Subscription businesses as an example. System Hub is a great example.
Yes,
yeah.
When it comes to, so let's say you check off quite a few of these things. And yes, you've got a moat around the business and you've got some subscription income built in. And let's say if you ticked off quite a few of these, is the end result to then come up with some sort of gauge where you could go, oh, okay, this might now be worth, you know, X number of multiples of profit. So kind of the pre-calculation is to figure out how much risk there is. And obviously the more risk, the lower that multiple should be, and the less risk, the higher the multiple.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So, I mean, clearly there are general sort of what might be called industry rules of thumb, businesses will can be valued along those lines where it's a multiple of profits. But, you know, I like to work with my clients to be able to get better than that. You know, we just don't want to be average. We don't want to be the norm. You know, and it will vary because it depends on the market conditions at the time. You know, if there's some big public companies out there going around, or international groups doing what's known as industry roll-ups. You know, there's a really good opportunity for you there to get a much better multiple. So timing is really important to be able to scan the market and see what's happening out there, have your ear to the ground, knowing what's going on in your industry as well.
And I remember reading an article that you had published around looking for the strategic buyer, because they're also going to be happier to pay higher multiples. If we think about a range, though, like you said, let's say the industry sort of averages, just as an idea, on, let's say, on the lower range of what someone might look at, but then let's say if someone worked with someone like yourself, was able to tick a lot of these boxes and make it very much a strategic buy, what the higher end of that range might, you know, be as far as like an increase on multiples of what they could have got?
Well, it can be basically, say, you know, 1 to 2, you know, it might be as low as that. And I think right now the average in across the board in the marketplace, that's, you know, you're lucky to get 2 times at the moment, generally speaking. I was just reading a report yesterday that came out where the average is around about 2. That's it.
The owner, let's say, taking a wage, because that's particularly for smaller businesses, that's quite often a common thing where the business owner, when they're trying to sell it, will calculate including, you know, the take home money as though their wage was part of that. Whereas obviously that's not really part of the business, because you're going to have to hire someone to run it.
Yeah. Well, that's a different calculation. So often there are what's called add backs when you're looking at the numbers to be able to come up with a number that is the operating profit of the business. So this will just depend a little bit on who you might be targeting. So part of this whole evaluation process as well is to think about, it's basically in the next stage. Once we've done the dive here to have a look and evaluate where the business is at, then we can do some further exploration and start thinking about, well, who might buy the business? And
let's move to that second stage.
So let's see if we can come up with maybe, a target of probably 10 potential strategic acquirers, if you like. So who would my business be attractive to? Who might want to buy the business, or who might want to buy a component of the business? You know, that's not always going to be the whole business that's sold, you know, that might actually only be a component of the business. And that might be a better way to go for some people. So it's really about sitting down, doing a brainstorm and thinking, let's see if I can come up with 10 businesses. And generally speaking, you would be looking at, you know, the whole range. Maybe it's a competitor. Yeah, it could possibly be the case. Maybe it is a large public group, for instance. It could be an international buyer. But let's see if we can sit down and brainstorm maybe at least 10 potential acquirers and then do a little bit of homework on that. Last week, I was just speaking to another client who's in the medical equipment servicing business. And baby boomer, you know, and there are 2 international groups now in Australia looking at creating national networks and buying up smaller businesses. So not only was the thought processes already started about exit and succession for that matter, but now there are opportunities for a bigger play, you know, with an international group coming into Australia to acquire those businesses. So it really means thinking about who's out there. So how can I make my business attractive? So exploring all of that, and also exploring your own personal goals. You know, one of the things that's really important for business owners is to think about life after business. For men in particular, unfortunately, you know, they have an identity that's really tied to their business, and that really needs, you need to think about, well, what am I going to do? It might be quite a few years down the track, but let's get the thought processes going now. And, you know, you need to create a new purpose for yourself in terms of life after business as well. So that's part of the whole exploration process. And your personal goals, what are they, you know, aside from business, what are your personal goals? The financial goals, what do you have? What are they? You know, what sort of money will you need to live on? What will be a nest egg for you for the future? And not only yourself, but also, you know, some of the other stakeholders and family that, you know, will be affected no matter what. And particularly with, again, if you've been running a business and then everything goes along really well, you get a great sale, you are out of your business, and then all of a sudden you're at home, you're trying to run the household the same way as you ran the business, well, you might find a little bit of conflict. So, you know, I think that this whole exploration process means looking at all of those areas and giving some thought to them and start discussions, start having the discussions.
With the exploration phase as well, and it might be covered in some of the later stages, how and at what point would you start seeding with potential acquirers? Because I'm imagining for a larger business, this is something that might have a long lead time, and the earlier that could be done, you know, it just stops having a forced must sell fire sale when it comes time.
Absolutely. So you start cultivating the relationships, basically, because they could be the biggest customer of your life, you know, so that's the most important thing. So once we've brainstormed some potential acquirers, then we start doing what every good salesperson would do, and that is to build relationships with those potential acquirers, you know. And ultimately, if you find, you know, you do that over a period of time, then you certainly reduce the strain, I suppose, you know, the stress that comes with, oh dear, I've got to sell the business. It's like, you know, most people might think this is a bit woo-woo, but it's like the universe, you know, sort of you're putting it out there, the energy is going there, and you'd be surprised at what happens. But yes, you do absolutely start cultivating the relationships, start going along to maybe conferences or network meetings or whatever, you know, to be able to do that. Yes.
Yeah, perfect. And then we move into the third step, the innovate step.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that the whole innovation process is around what we discover where the gaps are. So out of the first evaluation stage, that will give you feedback initially on where to concentrate your efforts. And this, the same thing with the explore stage. So we combine the two. So we've got the clinical analysis, if you like, and benchmarking analysis of your business from a few different sources. And then we say, righto, well, here are the gaps. It's giving us feedback on where the gaps are. Where, you know, are we a C-grade business? We need to be a B or an A, you know, get to a B and then to an A-grade business. And so through that process, we have identified where we need to concentrate our efforts. And again, when having explored potential acquirers, what are they looking for? You know, maybe we need to tweak the business in a way that actually makes us far more attractive to our potential acquirer. And so that's what we do through that whole innovation process. And the result of all that, of course, is that the value of the business increases enormously. And that's why I say to people, give yourself enough time. Don't sort of say, well, you know, I've got 6 months and I need to be out of the business. Well, sure, that look, you might find yourself in that situation, but touch wood, you don't, because one of the other areas that we do need to make sure that we're covered is to look at all contingencies. And one of those might be that there could be some business partners who are at different ages and stages. I do have another client where there were five shareholders and they ranged in age from 32 to 58. Well, obviously their aspirations are different because of the age difference. So we need to look at those sort of what options and what contingency plans are in place. And heaven forbid that anyone might become ill, you know, and they have to leave the business. So you know, addressing all of those potential issues is about de-risking. And so in the whole innovation process, that's what we do. And we concentrate on the value drivers, where the gaps are, what we can do to close those gaps. And the result of it is incredible improvement in business value. Yeah.
What are some of those value drivers? Obviously, some of the things that you're looking in at the evaluate stage uncover some of those opportunities. Are there certain things where you kind of commonly see working on these areas adds significant value?
Sure. I mean, it's about where's the biggest bang for your buck, basically. You know, what can you do? And, you know, there's always an order of priority as to where you can get the best results. So let's say, for instance, look on the financial side. Maybe, you know, most private business owners have, and rightly so, drawn the profits from the business. We're assuming we've got a nice successful business here and they've drawn the profits from the business, but they've all sort of in that process perhaps artificially changed the bottom line. So let's have a look at how do we need, like what do we need to do to actually restore the bottom line to its proper results, you know, and that's why time's really important, you know, to be able to do that so that you don't do it in one go, you know, you over a period of time, you actually make sure that those adjustments are right. The other thing is too around business growth, and it may be because you've concentrated on, you know, just drawing profits from the business that you haven't put money back into the business to actually be able to grow it. So again, we would look at that and say, well, do we need to do something here? What else do we need to do to be able to grow the business? Maybe there's, you know, frankly, Dave, one of the biggest issues I see is that people do not have their businesses systemized. They do not have their intellectual property sitting in a system. I'm not talking about inventions or technical expertise in that regard. I'm talking about the basic everyday systems that make life easy for somebody in their business. And that's an area that is always, frankly, I am yet to go into a business where I see it perfect.
I think that's obviously one of the things that has connected us and why we've got a couple of shared clients is it's kind of like both of these topics go hand in hand.
It's always a shortfall. You know, that's about that's a huge part about de-risking the business. So if you can walk out of the business and it can run without you because it's fully systemized, people know where to go, they know where to find information, they know A, B, C, this is the way things are meant to happen. That is the most valuable business that you can possibly have, quite frankly.
It's a hard one to answer because I try and calculate and think about how much value systemizing a business can add. And it's so difficult to calculate because it'll increase efficiency, it'll reduce waste, it will add the value just by having it there because of that succession. I am curious, have you got any idea where you could say a well-systemized business could sell for, you know, a multiple of 2 times more or 3 times more? Or I know it's very hard to say though.
Look, I don't think I could probably be as definitive as that, but there is absolutely no doubt that that's about risk. So yes. It will definitely increase the value of the business. And, you know, definitely add 30 or 40%, without a doubt, I'm sure, you know, being able to do that. And even businesses that have gone through some certifications, like the, you know, ISO type certification, are good in the technical aspect that they are going through to get certified, but it's everything else that just gets left, you know. So, you know,
there's answering phones and following up leads and...
Correct. So, I mean, a marketing system, my goodness, if that would be the most valuable part of any business, if if you've got that well systemized, there is no doubt in my mind that could quadruple a value of a business, because so few businesses do that. You know, they are really stand out to be able to do that.
And then we kind of move into that final stage, which is the transition stage. What sort of things do we address there? Like at this point, I'm assuming you've thought about your business and where it's at, and potentially, you know, moved into that step two to explore and see what else is out there. And then the innovation really sounds like it's a lot to do with the implementation, about what you uncover, where you are, what you know the person wants to see when they're buying to add the most value, and your building that bridge and you're filling those gaps. And now we're kind of talking to that stage four now.
Correct. So one of the last things we do in stage three, though, is to do what I call a mock due diligence. So we go through the business to do another sweep to see if I was a buyer, what would I want from the business? And due diligence, especially for a business owner, so we want to get through it and have it all ready, and we've got, so that we've got everything ready, we just do one that's a practice, and we make sure that we have all information, because we've gone through and systemized and done everything, then we make sure we have all the information, and we put it in a data vault, like just electronic data vault, and so when the time comes, it just makes life so much easier. So moving on to step four,
you've piqued my interest now. Like what sort of things then would go into that due diligence pack? Obviously some financials. What other things might go in there?
You'd want evidence of all your paperwork, in like evidence of all your legal status, you know, with your company details and all of that sort of stuff. You would want contracts, copies of all your contracts, if you, whatever contracts there are, whether it's with suppliers or clients or staff for that matter. You'd want all your policies and procedures all there in that data vault as well. You would want evidence of and sort of justification of your marketing positioning, your, you know, if you've got external references or testimonials, all that sort of stuff that, you know, you know, here as well, which you not only have for due diligence purposes, but also for your marketing purposes. You'd want to see your any IP registrations, domain names, password lists, you name it. In fact, a business recently that is has just been given a list of one of my clients that I'm working with now, and she's just been given a list for due diligence. Fortunately, we have already been through this, so it's been relatively painless for her to be able to.
So the due diligence list usually comes from the client. It's not like you're offering up the Dropbox folder. You've got it all there. They ask you and then you just go, here it is.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
And there were 300 questions. There were 300 items on that list that they were asked to provide.
And ballpark, like what type of, because obviously the depth of questions would depend on the value of the business, because they want to de-risk probably the more that they're spending, no doubt. For something that's 300 questions long, are we talking like a sort of eight-figure business? Are we talking higher? What sort of?
Well, that's a million-dollar business.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just doing your due diligence. And let me say that that goes two ways. So you want to do your due diligence. Admittedly, you can't necessarily put up a 300-question list, you know, that you want on a potential acquirer. But it's just as important for you to do your due diligence on an acquirer as it is to do it on you, because you might have certain, you know, you might have certain criteria that you want to make sure happens. And I guess I'll use my example. When I sold my first business in international freight forwarding, one of the key criteria I had was that everybody had a job. The only person out of a job was me.
Yes.
So I didn't want anybody, and we were approached by several others, but I was really, that was a go or no go for me.
Yeah.
And so the business who eventually acquired us was an international group. They had no representation in Australia, and they had instant representation.
Yes, yeah.
Premises and everything, you know, when they bought our business. So, so yes, you need to do your due diligence on that potential acquirer and make sure that you're happy with who they are. Is it a company like the Pretty Woman company, you know, the movie Pretty Woman, where the Richard Gere character, whose name escapes me right now, his modus operandi was he'd go out and buy all these businesses and then strip it, you know, strip the assets out and be out of work and, you know, end of story. So if that's what you'd be satisfied with happening, or it's not of any concern to you, that's fine. I have no judgment whatsoever against any of that. But so know that that's who you're, what you're potentially facing. So two-way street, really, in terms of due diligence. But the they'll want all your figures. You know, they'll want all your financials. I've heard it referred to as something like a proctorial examination.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And I know I have heard people say basically the price that you might have initially started at, there, every question they're asking that doesn't quite reflect something that you've said is a chance for them to negotiate down.
It is. And that's quite, you know, don't go into a due diligence exercise with your eyes shut, because that really is the first place to start for negotiating what might seem to be your number. It's going to be the place that they're going to start negotiating it down. Okay. So, and obviously, but one of the most important parts before that, of course, is that you sign a confidentiality agreement or a non-disclosure agreement that is tight, that has times, because once an acquirer gets the information that you are going to provide as part of your due diligence at this stage, you're opening up everything.
Mm-mm.
So you've got to be confident that you're going to be able to progress this beyond this stage.
Yes. And then I suppose we move into that next stage, which is the transition stage. What does this refer to? Is this the negotiation component, or is this the handover, or all of the above?
Correct. All of the above. So, you know, we've done our practice due diligence, so we're good to go on that one. At this point, you know, you may or may not want to invest in a formal valuation. That might just depend, you know,
yes,
on the business, because a potential acquirer will, you'll know already by this point whether in fact there's an offer on the table that you'd be willing to accept. The thing here too is that terms are as important, if not more important, than price.
Yes.
Price is what you pay, value is what you get. That's another Warren Buffett quote. Okay. Yeah. And the terms of a deal are really, really important. Great story. Someone I met in the US last year, Stephanie Breedlove, beautiful lady, created a fantastic business with her husband ultimately, where they were providing accounting services for families, for nannies.
Okay? Yeah, wow. What a niche. Yeah.
I know. Pardon me. And they'd grown the business to a $9 million revenue business. All recurring revenue.
Wow. Yeah.
Unbelievably so. Huge growth opportunities, because they were only in a couple of locations. And
yep.
Their margin was on the bottom line, was staggering when they eventually got past all the hurdles.
Yeah.
Excuse me, was about 50%.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, it was great. Anyway, and I think they had employed about 20 people even. It was terrific.
Yeah, so, very light.
Yep. So she was approached by a company called care.com to sell the business.
Yeah.
They initially offered her $36 million.
So And the way that they would have arrived at that, because there's, I mean, it's accounting business, so really the main thing there is the potentially turnover. Strategic play obviously is going to be another thing. But going back to what we said before, if they're turning over 9, you know, we're probably talking, I think you said 36 there, so that's probably what, 4 times earnings or thereabouts?
Well,
or not earnings, sorry.
Turned it down. Okay, she turned it down.
Oh, so, wow. Yes, yeah. Okay.
Okay. So the interesting part about this, of course, was that she and her husband looked at it and said, well, $36 million, it's nine, you know, we are actually making $4.5 million a year. We're living a very comfortable lifestyle. You know, it's, the business is going along really well. It's working like clockwork. You know, that's sort of for the next, and they're relatively young. They're only in their 40s. Then, you know, 10 years, then we can chunk along for 10 years. That'll be fine. You know,
yeah, sorry, that's probably 9 times profit there. Okay. Which is quite high on that scale we were talking about. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So yep. The interesting part of it all is that, the acquirer, care.com, their business was the opposite of that of Stephanie's business. So they worked with big groups.
Yeah.
So the fit for them strategically was a huge expansion in a market that they could access.
Yeah.
So anyway, care.com, so they turned it down.
Yeah, yeah.
They came back 6 months later and said, how much do you want? And I think Stephanie said that they said 60 million and they eventually settled on 54 and they 50% was cash and 50% was in shares in care.com. So, I mean, these are the sorts of deals that go on.
Yeah, got it.
They had a 2-year earnout. They had certain profit hurdles that they had to reach in that period. They knocked it out of the park and they knew they would. And within 18 months, and as Stephanie finished up in the business after that. And she's a beautiful lady and she now spends her time mentoring, and she's a business angel and, you know, mentoring other business women. But I think the key elements in there is that the value that was there was because of the strategic play
and was recurring the biggest revenue. Driver. Yeah.
Yes, the recurring revenue. And a bit of guts to say, you know, no.
Yeah, I know. Especially such a high valuation there.
Correct. So you can't put a number around those.
Yes, yeah.
You know, you can't put a multiple number, and that's the genius of if you can find a strategic buyer,
yes.
Somebody who can take your business, because for them it's an arbitrage, okay?
Yeah.
So they're going to pay you a multiple, but there are obvious synergies, there are obvious savings. They're going to turn that. That profit that was being generated in that business into a multiple many times over when they're a listed company, because as you know, with the listed companies, the price earnings multiples are much higher than they are for private businesses, and the arbitrage that's there between what you might get 5 or 6 times, which you think is great. Let's face it, that story with Stephanie and care.com, they're the one that out of the bag type store.
Yes, yeah. Exception, not the rule.
Not the norm. They're not the norm. And so you might say, okay, well, I'm getting a 10 times valuation, which actually occurred with another one of my clients in an industry roll-up. They were paid the revenue of the business, which actually turned out to be a 10 times multiple.
Yeah, wow.
But it was a public company and their PE was 16. So they might have been paid a 10 times multiple, but the public company already gained more than a 50% uplift by bringing it into their
business.
Okay. So really it boils down to what's the number that you're happy with? Okay. What do you need to have to live on for the rest of your life? What's the number happy with? Are you happy with the outcome? Have you figured out what you're going to do? What's your second purpose? What's your next reinvention? So for me, I'm in my fifth reinvention. And so you can be happy with what's transpired, and you've got a sense of purpose for the rest of your life. Yeah.
I suppose in the tail end, I'm just trying to think if there are any final questions I might have for that transition, because I know we're kind of just coming to the close now. Things like, I suppose it really comes down.
But that's one thing I haven't actually even touched on yet.
Oh,
you go. It's really important to get the right financial advice in this regard too, and make sure that you've got all your estate planning set up correctly.
Yes.
Because a lot of, often, you know, you as private businesses, especially, you have trust. I mean, I'm not a financial advisor, just speaking from a place of experience, that's all. And, you know, don't take any of this as gospel, but it's a case of, you know, you often have things set up in trusts. Have you got your wills and things organized? You know, sometimes, depending on your structure, you might say, oh, I want this to go to somebody. You know, you can't will trusts. You can't will assets in trust. So you've got to get all these things sorted out. But right at the top level, of course, it's about making sure you've got the right financial advice to have all of the legal requirements, taxation requirements, and you know we'd address that anyway a little bit earlier than this and then this stage, but just to make sure that you've got everything set up properly.
Yeah, perfect. Well, we might wrap it up from there. I know if people want to keep an eye on what you're up to and find out more, because it's really a deep topic and we've just kind of scratched the surface. I know you've got your book, which people can get from the website. The best place for people to go?
Yeah, look, I think the best place is to go to get a complimentary copy of my book, which is to freeexitstrategybook.com.au.
Perfect. And I'll just pop a link near this interview as well. So thank you so much, Kerry, for your time. And no doubt we'll keep chatting together and working together and have a part two, no doubt.
Fantastic. Thanks, Dave.